Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, Heritage Radio Network has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guests are Stephanie and Edward from Gut Ogau. And our other guest is Christian Schieder, all from Burgenland in Austria. We'll talk to Steph and Edward first about their wines. I want to talk to them about Caractère in New York City and more. Maybe we'll talk about some wines we're tasting. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Stephanie and Edward are the proprietors and winemakers at Gut Ogau, their winery in Ogau in the Burgenland region of Austria. They restored a 17th century winery and now farm biodynamically. They created a unique family of wines by field blending the grapes from the region. Is that an accurate introduction?
Amazing.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
So you guys, welcome back to the Grape Nation. You were on 4.5 years ago, but we did it by phone.
Yeah, it was
so
great.
Stephanie, I've seen you at Raw Wine from time to time, but to sit with both of you together, you know, I'm very thrilled. We're talking to Steph and Edward at our friend Adam Sachs' house in Brooklyn for a party hosted by our friend Marco Kovash. Celebrating Caractère coming to New York City November 5th, Saturday. We're sitting here the Sunday before. So I think I answered the question, but tell me why you're in New York City.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for having us. And it's always, I think, a good reason to travel, and especially to New York, if Marco is calling us, we are coming.
So Marco calls, you come. All right. That's nice. And he's calling you because he's brought Caractère to New York City.
Yeah, New York, yes.
So that's really why you're here, Marco, Caractère. I think, Edward, you and I talked offline, something very special. Your kids are with you.
Yeah, exciting for us as well. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's
a good opportunity. There's school holidays in Austria now, and we decided to bring them because, as you said, 4.5 years ago, we met for the first time at Raw and then had this interview. But ever since, you know, we love to go back to New York, and like we're meeting lots of friends, and we want to kind of share the experience with our kids as well.
Yeah, it's great that, you know, they're at the travel age and, you know, you could take them around. I want to hear it from you guys because you've participated and you're participating. Tell me about Caractère, you know, from your perspective. You know, what is it? I think it hits home literally because there's a big focus on Austrian wines, you know, European and all that. But tell me what Caractère is.
I mean, personally, for me, it's more like gathering together what we love and people who we love and having a great time, but not superficial, more like going into deep, having time to reflect on, you know, like the vintage, the year. Yeah, and being together and having a great energy and good conversations.
So is the people that come through on Saturday, it's going to be trade and consumer? It'll be a mixture? I mean, who will most of the people that will be there?
I would guess so. It will be a good mix.
It will be a mix.
But certainly the common sense is, you know, a certain hedonistic touch, people who love natural wines, who love a certain spirit of wine, a certain energy, and that's what they're going to find there.
Yeah, I think, you know, credit Marco for doing that. Has it become important? Is it important? Is it important to your business to have these salons and wine fairs? I mean, do they help you with exposure, with sales? I mean, is that an important part of a character?
I would say salons used to be important for us, rather when we started and the years after. Now, as such, the salon for the sales is not important, but it's really important for us to once in a while travel, to see and meet friends, to make an exchange, to get inspired.
So that's... That connection is important.
The connection and the spirit created through a certain crowd, that's what's important, that's what's precious to us. But in terms of sales, you know, our quantities are limited. The demand is luckily quite high, given we've been working on this seriously for 15 years now. People trust in our approach, trust in our vineyards, trust in us. So there's no need to, say, represent the wines for the sales purpose. It's really mainly for the connection and for the energy.
So there was the old question, is it harder to make wine or to sell it? And you kind of answered the question, because you don't make that much wine. It's popular and sells. So it's important to have some soul and connect with people.
Yeah, and to see also the places like where the wines are getting served. You know, like I love to see like where our fictional wine family is going to, you know, like, and if it feels comfortable, you know, like also
right.
They travel
right
alongside, you know.
It's funny because, and we'll talk about it in a minute, but it's literally a wine family. I mean, we have the wines lined up against the window. We're sitting outside and we're staring at a family. Your own wines are your own family, but there's like a face to these wines. So it's like, how's my family doing? So you come and visit the family, which is really nice.
Yeah, and we take it really personal in the best sense. And it's a very emotional connection we have with our wines. And, you know, like when we bottle, when the wines are sent abroad, we cannot necessarily follow them. But once in a while, we can go and visit and then see how they behave, how they are treated. And that's also essential, you know, how they make people feel. They create happiness, they create vitality in people's minds and spirits, and that's really a beautiful thing for us.
I'm guessing people have a reverence for the wine, but when you go out and visit, you feel that everyone appreciates it and, you know, enjoys the wines, right?
Yeah, and for us it's also maybe a little bit of our hometown, Burgenland, to bring to New York, you know, like because the wines are so unique and so full of energy from this the
well, so let's talk about that, because that's really, you know, what it's about. You guys have owned the winery, I guess it's over 15 years already.
Yeah.
2007, Edward and I were talking, you were pregnant when you bought the winery. You know, and the beautiful thing is now your kids are around. So that's 15 plus years ago.
But it doesn't feel like.
Well, that's great, because that means you love what you're doing and you love raising your kids around it. But let's talk about some of the changes or challenges or accomplishments you've experienced through the 15 years. I mean, you're probably smarter, better, but tell me, like, you know, when you look back that long ago and you look back now, what's going on? I mean, I know the wines are more accepted, but what about, has it become harder to farm? Has it become... You know,
I mean, I'm married with a man who is so particular in perfection in producing wines in the fields, in the vineyards. Now we are having three horses. He's so into all the preparations. I think, yeah.
So Edward, introduce horses?
Yeah, we
why it took so long?
You know, it needs to be the right time and the right momentum, and it's quite an intense work, and like training the horses, training us to do this. But we have three horses we work the vineyards with. Not all of the fields we can do yet, because still young horses and we need to get them in shape. But most of the vineyards we can cover now, and that's really exciting for us. I mean, again, that's a next step we took, but there's so many more to come. So, like, also asking referring to your question, everything is always in motion, you know. what's it all about? The way we farm, the way we understand our vineyards is to get them into a certain balance. But balance is not the stage as such, you know, it always needs to be fine-tuned, we need to adapt. Everything is changing around, you know, vintages are changing, climate is changing. So we better be sensitive, we better understand the needs of the fields, of the plants, and then react on this. So it's an ever-going process, you know. So we are, of course, wiser, more experienced. But that experience also tells us that we need to be really humble and we need to understand that what has been good this year to work the vines with is probably not the best next year. So we always need to be open-minded.
Like starting over or really looking at everything like we have to start with a clean slate?
I mean, I have to say, like, with the first questions, like, I mean, of course, when we started 15 years ago, the idea or the goal was to produce the best wine.
Right.
At the end, it's so much more. You know, like, right. After 15 years, for us, it's...
It's not the liquid in the bottle
entirely. Exactly. It's,
right?
It's the energy you bring into the bottle. It's like the energy in the vineyards. It's about the earth. It's about so many other aspects. Like, what you always say, and it's so beautiful, like, it's not only the material. What we are taking is also the cosmic, which is so important to be with both very much connected, you know?
Yeah, so in other words, you know, it takes the feet firmly in the ground, but it also needs the head up in the sky, you know? We need to find this balance as well. It's not just about the matter underneath. It's also about all the energy surrounding it.
But isn't it fair to say you're alluding to biodynamics, where there's this whole, you know, kind of energy, you know, not just the soil, but, you know, the moon phases and preparation. I mean, is that part of it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, from the start, actually, we worked on biodynamics, our vineyards. And probably at the start, it was more like a farming technique method for us.
Right.
But it quickly became, and it should become, if you take it seriously,
a lifestyle.
As such, because it's an holistic approach, you know, it's not just about how you farm your land, it's about how you, because we mentioned before, raise your kids, what you consume, how you consume, how you consider everything around, you know, everything is important equally.
Right.
Yeah, and then you realize, you know, like, you're on a point where there is, you can't get further, but at the end, you want to go further, and that's where you take it as
right.
a whole thing, you know, like,
right.
you don't want to be limited, you know, like, and if you take it seriously, then there is no limitation.
Right.
And this is the beauty, you know?
Right. And what drives me crazy is, why would you do anything but that? You know, why wouldn't you? I mean, it's so important to be in tune with everything and to honor the earth and just everything around it. How do you go back to doing it any other way? And as people continue, I'm sure there are people around you that are, you know, not as committed.
Of course there are, and of course there's different paces and different rhythms, but in the end, you know, nobody can be prevented from getting wiser on a daily basis,
right.
You know, but it's always important, like, to be open-minded and to understand that, again, what used to be right is not necessarily right nowadays, and sometimes you just have to trust your feelings and your, say, gut feelings rather than
so
being too much, like,
mind-driven. You said what used to be right may not be right now. I mean, can you think of something that kind of made sense and now it doesn't? You know, as far as what wasn't right, what's not right now that seemed right then? I mean,
yeah, say, for example, like the biodynamic treatments we do, the way we did in the early days, of course, is different from what we do now because vegetation period has changed, everything is starting earlier. Harvest is much earlier than it used to be. In between, there's far more extremes. You know, there's very dry, hot periods followed by cool, wet.
To climate changing, right?
Of course. I mean,
yeah.
We rather talk of a climate fracture, actually. It's not a change for us because change happens naturally forever and always. What happened in the recent decades is rather fracture. You know, that's totally upside down everything. But it has already happened to a certain extent.
Right.
We still have the chance to kind of slow it down or to kind of freeze it in. But certainly that change has already happened. So we need to adapt.
Is that what you're left to do? You have to freeze it or slow it down? I mean, that's all you can do to kind of stay at the pace?
I would say everybody can contribute to this.
Right.
They are not only us,
but
of
I mean,
course.
In order for you to do vintage to vintage, in order to stay with the changing climate, you have to pivot and make, you know, different decisions, right?
Yeah, and we can have a strong impact, and we can contribute a lot as farmers in general. And that's also, say, our mission is a strong word, but we want to make people aware of, you know.
Right.
Agriculture in general causes so many problems nowadays, also in terms of global warming and everything. But it can, on the same hand, provide so many solutions if you take it seriously. And if you have a certain sustainable farming approach, lots of things can be corrected again or can be, like I said, frozen in, which not only about vineyards, you know, it's about agriculture in general. And that drives us as well,
right,
you know, to make people aware,
right,
of this.
Yeah. It is agriculture.
Yeah, but we have lots of tools, of course, which we can use, like the tea preparations, then the compost, which we produce by ourselves, you know, because also in our region we couldn't find the perfect compost, like building more humus on the top of the earth, you know, like
on the topsoil.
Of the topsoil. And then, of course, what we did now, like 8 years ago almost, like looking for places where there was not vineyards before, but we knew that it's going to be, if the change or the fracture is going on in this way, we have to look for places where it's a perfect balance again,
right,
again for, you know, like...
So what's interesting is the property that you're on, and I want you to give people a little snapshot because they get to know you a little and maybe they've tried the wines or, you know, drink them. But you are in Burgenland in the town of Ogau, and you're about an hour outside of Vienna. Tell me, it's kind of a unique place. Just give me a little snapshot of, you know, climate, soil. I mean, you guys, you're not planting rows of varietals. You're field blending. I mean, just give me a quick, you know, discussion.
Yeah, try to make it short. Yeah, so Austria, like eastern part of Austria, which is not the Sound of Music Austria,
right,
many people know, but it's rather flat there. So we're rather close to Hungary, a couple of kilometers from the Hungarian border. And we are on the west bank of the Lake Neusiedl, which is quite a big, very flat lake. So huge influential on the climate there, balancing out the temperatures day and night. But on the west bank where we are still on this hilly landscape, which is kind of the eastern edge of the Alps. So we have a beautiful cool influence from the Alps, paired with this rather warm influence from the Pannonic Plain area and the lake. So it's a super, super nice combination of a certain, say, subtle maturity we get in the grapes plus the freshness, and on top we have several different soil types, all in a very minerally crystal clear terroir idea. So there's limestone, there's slate, there's gravel, hardly any loam, so no fat, no concentrated soil, so keeps the wines always straight, always very eclectic, very
sounds ideal,
very,
yeah,
very much alive.
Now are the parcels, the soils vary? It's not the same everywhere. Like this parcel may have more of something than another parcel, or?
Yeah, so it's like historically, because our now Burgenland part of Austria used to be part of the Hungarian legacy during the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And there the law of heritage claimed that each child would get the same piece of land, rather than, say, on the Austrian side, where the oldest son basically would inherit all the land. So what happened in our area is during the generations, the parcels have gotten smaller and smaller, more and more divided through heritage. So in the end, now we work on more than 60 different parcels of vineyards, some rather close together, some further apart, some in the flatland, some on the hillside, some on gravel, as mentioned, some on limestone, some on a mix of limestone and slate, whatever reference there is. So there's several soil types, several types of topography. And from the start, Steffi and I, we decided to blend all those vineyards with the same character, the same identity of soil. Say, for example, all the white vineyards on gravel are blended into one personality, because those vineyards, they create for us the same character of wine, and that's why we blend them. You know, we co-pick them even if the grapes are ripe at the same time. So there's no intention to to define wines through the cellar or the tasting,
right.
But everything is predefined through the vineyards.
Right.
And that's how
not even the varietal too, right? It's what's out in the field.
Yeah, and at the end, you know, like right? The varietal for us is more the, I don't know how you say that, like it's giving you the information of your vineyard, you know, like, and it's like a transmitter, you know, like it's
right.
The in between, it's like giving to you the electricity. You
right,
know?
It's very cool in that sense. Yeah. And what's kind of unique, and we talked about this on the last show because it was so compelling to me then, but I'm used to it, is the philosophy of the wines and how you make them. I mean, it's literally a family. It's identified by faces, and it runs the range of ages from younger people to old people, and the type of wines that are reflected in those labels are identified by that. Just tell everyone a little about, you know, the faces and the labels.
Yeah, as mentioned, it's a fictional wine family, and for us, when we started, we kind of took over this abandoned vineyard back in end of 2006, beginning of 2007. So we kind of had a blank sheet. You know, it's been old vineyards, quite grown up in terms of age, so between 30 and 60 years then. But the former owners for years didn't produce wine. They would only sell the grapes. So in the end, we didn't know about the potential of the vineyards. We needed to find out. And the way we found out back then was to go this natural wine approach, which is now also more or less common sense what it means. Back then, the term natural wine wasn't even born yet. So we kind of did it because we felt it was right without
right.
any, say, ideal in front of us or whatever. So long story short, the first vintage in, the wines were fermenting. We regularly tasted them of curiosity, also of insecurity to a certain extent because we didn't really know what we were up to. But what struck us from the start was how unique those wines have been and how alive, and each was feeling such strongly as a personality, as a character. And that one late night, I would say, after tasting a lot of wines, brought us on this track to identify the wines as personalities, means we described them as if they were persons.
Right.
And the faces, they symbolize the character of the wine. So the faces are illustrations of the personal description we gave to each wine. And it's three generations because those vineyards would simply tell us different stories in terms of character. You know, some vineyards would be rather youthful, expressive, cheeky in their personality. Some would be more, say, mature, more settled. Some would even be full of wisdom, a little bit grumpy, whatever. But those personalities are all defined by the soil, by the vineyards, by the topography, whatever comes along.
And by the face on the label. And
the face then tells this
right.
character.
What is nice is, like, you know, like to have now so many people who love it, because when we started, nobody liked it.
They didn't?
No.
I don't think they didn't like it. I think they just didn't understand it or weren't used to it.
No, but you know, like the wine was a little bit strange, then the faces on the label, they are not funny faces, or they don't smile, and people were like, no, it's such a bad idea. You know, like I studied art. For us, it was like a normal thing, like because of course, wine is a culture, but it's such a living product for us. You know,
right.
Like it's a living.
That's exactly
thing,
what
you know?
It is.
And now it's beautiful that people love it, like we did from the beginning.
So, it is a beautiful thing that people love it. And as you said earlier, you only make so much wine. Have you expanded a little? Have you taken on some new property? Are you making a little more wine?
I mean, of course, in the end, we had a certain organic growth, I would say. So in the early days, we simply did not have enough wine from those old vineyards. So we needed to add a few neighboring pieces here and there also to kind
because
of survive.
Because the crop was really, really low because the wines are, the vineyards are really old.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, like...
Yeah, we need to, you know, refinance the bank loan, whatever it took. So we kind of organically grew. But only to the certain extent that we could still digest this growth, you know, and also
right.
in terms of like work structure, dedication. We never wanted to make any compromise in any vineyards and never did. So we found this beautiful balance on that as well. What we did recently, and that only starting in 2018, is certainly also for us a crucial answer to what we talked about before, global warming and all the challenges we're facing. 2018 was the first year we planted vineyards ourselves, but that in a totally different system, which is not common in our area. So we go for a very dense planting, single stick training, no wires.
It's like bush wines.
Yeah, doesn't that have a name? Like
Stockkultur, it's called in Austria. It's an ancient way of training, but there is no wire, no metal in the vineyards, no plastic. It's everything like compostable, close, dense planting. So actually the vines are on an early stage encouraged to grow deep with the roots, to get the water they don't have probably on the surface, to put shadow on each other. We cannot work with any heavy machines. It's only the horses, so no compression on the soil. So good for the soil life, so amazingly healthy for the vitality. So that's certainly paired with, a permacultural approach. We have like co-planting trees, bushes, beehives in the vineyards, whatever it takes to break the monocultural system.
The vegetables we do there, you know, like also for our tavern, which we have on our place.
Yeah, so that's certainly for us a conclusion and an answer for the future.
We got to wrap up, but I think as a parent, one of the cool things to me is that when you took on the winery, Stephanie, you were pregnant, and we're talking 15 plus years later, and that should be about, you know, your oldest kid's age. So now part of your life between the two of you making wine and what wine is all about is you have your kids around you.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I mean, are they out there helping? I mean, do you give them space? I mean, how does that work, having kids around a winery?
I mean, of course, but I think we are both way too young to you know, like thinking of, you know, like if somebody is taking over or not, you know, like we are so...
Yeah, we're not there yet.
We are not there
That has to happen
all.
Naturally. Yeah. And you can't make them.
And we have so many still ideas what we want to do, and we are still not... there where we want to see, you know, it's a learning.
Do they seem engaged? I mean, do they like to be around it? Is it fun or is
it?
No,
they love it.
They
do. Yeah. I mean, like all the kids, if you tell them to clean their horses' stable, they love it on the first day, but the next day.
It's all right. Yeah. The novelty of that, you know, goes away. Well, it'll be, like you said, like you farm biodynamically and organically, it'll be an organic thing whether the kids,
I mean,
you know, want to be part of this 10, 15 years
from now. No, they always tell us, you work so hard.
They tell you?
Yes, and you never have money. And you're always stressed. That this is how they
get kids. That's a value they don't realize they're seeing. That, you know, it prioritizes what's important, which is love of what you do, passion. You know, the product that you turn out has to be the way you want it.
They
should only grow up, and they will, with those values, you know.
Yeah, and at the end, of course, like working the way we do, we always have one eye glancing towards the future, the next generations, you know, to preserve the land and to build up a healthy soil, whatever. It's not, I mean, we cannot, like, say, pick the crop of the seeds we are throwing now. But whether it's our kids or somebody else in the end, we will see. But, I mean, we give them a good basement, you know, so they know what's important in life. Whatever choice they take, we will certainly support them in any ways.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like also Good Auger is more like what we realized now through so many people who are doing a stage at our place. It's more a platform of reconnecting again, you know, like with your body, with your soul, with earth in general, you know, like, and this is so beautiful to give people the platform to see what is really at the end important, you know.
So I have a proposition for you. I have a proposal.
You come to work with us.
That's it. So here's the pitch. I think it would be wonderful to do a multi-segment show of a harvest. You know, being out there and documenting it and really, you know, my shows are usually an hour or so, but really doing a separate series, you know, where
I always tell people, if they are telling me, I want to come for harvest. Harvest is more the cherry of the chocolate cake.
So
it's
then
like
that
you need to build the chocolate cake first.
So I defer to you. I mean, I, you know, I almost need to put a... you know, a business plan together of what would be the most compelling and interesting thing, pulling back the curtains. Because you're right. Everybody knows what harvest is. And, yeah, you know, I'm in the tank cleaning it out, or I'm picking grain. I think there's more to it. So I want to, you know, talk to you about that, because I think, you know, you guys are the best. I think the area is terrific. The wines are terrific. I think how you do it. I just have to figure out, you know, what, and where I won't, like, pass out in the middle of the segment, yeah. You know.
No, but I mean, totally excited about it, because that's also what for us is so crucial. You know, our doors are always open. We want to definitely share what we are doing, why we are doing, how we are doing the things. Because
that's
like,
the part. The more people see the wine and the label, I kind of, you know, all of what we talked about is really what I want to like unravel for people. Yeah. It's like,
and
being
it's
on
also,
the ground.
Yeah, if we can inspire other farmers, other growers, that's to work the in
other
the same
thing.
Idea.
I think you have already, but you always will be able to continue.
Yeah, that would be great. So doors are open whenever. We'll
right.
sort it out.
We'll figure it out.
Stay tuned.
As soon as next year. All right, we got to wrap up. I want to thank Stephanie and Edward, Chepe Eselbach.
Perfectly said.
I got that. For joining us on the Grape Nation. It was a pleasure to sit with you while you were in New York City for Caractère. Caractère, I got that right. That is November 5th in New York at Rockefeller Center. You'll probably see stuff on Instagram and you'll hear about it, but certainly it'll be a great opportunity for a lot of wineries to come to New York and really, you know, show their work. So we're excited about that. All right. Thank you, Stephanie and Edward. You've been listening to the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben-Ruby.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new series on Heritage Radio Network called The Culinary Call Sheet, where we give a peek into the back kitchen of culinary media. I'm your host, April Jones.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Bresnitz. Part of why we started this show was to offer an unofficial mentorship for anyone who is interested in learning about all aspects of food and video, whether that's TV, social media, online, or just something you want to do for fun.
Absolutely. What was once niche or a little silly, as I'm sure you remember, Darren, when we started out.
Yes, ma'am.
Has now become such a massive playing field for so many creatives using food as the medium.
It's something that has driven us professionally and personally for so many years. What excites me the most about this show is that we're going to sit down with some of the industry leaders to hear how they made it and what drew them into this industry.
With 20 years in the culinary production game ourselves, we're hoping we can give, through these conversations, an insider's view into personal stories from the field, as well as an in-depth behind-the-scenes look into some of the most popular food programming in today's evolving culinary media landscape.
We'll be covering everything from how to style your food, to how to license IP, to developing your own ideas, and some tips from the masters of how to host your own show.
Yeah, it's a little bit of conversation, how to, and how do you do the things that you do in culinary media, which I'm so excited about. I love so many of the guests that are coming on this season. We have talent from Food Network, from Vice Media, Eater, Refinery29.
We've met some of the best people in the world, both in front of and behind the camera. And we're bringing them all together to share their stories, their delicious adventure, and their unique journey into this crazy world.
So to be the first to hear our episodes when they launch this fall, go to wherever podcasts are streaming and hit subscribe, and make sure to give us a follow at the Culinary Call Sheet on Instagram.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. For the second part of our interview, we're talking to Christian Schieder, proprietor of his eponymous winery in Ilmitz in Austria. We'll talk to Christian about his wines, character, why he's in New York, and more. All right, so Christian Schieder, that's how you pronounce it, right?
Yes.
Christian Schieder is a fourth-generation winemaker in the Burgenland region of Austria. Christian farms organically and biodynamically with incredible attention to detail in the vineyard and the cellar. He has helped pioneer the low-intervention natural wine movement in Austria and beyond. His wines are aromatic, textured, and with a lot of finesse. He makes wines from Pinot Blanc to Zweigelt, Riesling, Syrah, and more, and we're going to talk about that. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Christian.
Hello, Sam. Hi, guys out there. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm excited to sit down with you. I've been looking forward to this. So we're talking to Christian today in New York City. We decided to sit outside on 23rd Street. So you may hear some background noise, but that's okay. That's what New York's about. All right, so Christian, let's get a few things out of the way. Tell me why you're in New York City.
I'm in New York. I arrived today because in the weekend there will be the big character show.
Okay.
Yeah, gathering of nice winemakers showing their stuff in New York. First time.
I want to talk a little about that.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping you're doing dinners, seeing accounts, meeting up with people, right? Take advantage of all that?
Yes. There will be a very nice dinner at Attaboy tomorrow.
Right.
On Thursday. And then there will be a dinner at Le Roc on Friday.
So you're hitting some very, very special places.
With our friend Jorge.
Right.
Yeah.
Who I saw the other night. All right, so tell me a little about character. I think you'd be good as anybody because you've been a participant. It happened recently in Austria, less than a year ago.
Yes.
And I guess Marco Kovac decided New York would be a great place to do it. But first, tell everyone, you know, what character is. Would you say it's a wine salon? Describe.
I would say, in my opinion, it's a very, very relaxed. So that's why I'm here, because it's relaxed. But it's a very also noble. And noble, I mean, in a very positive way, because people are that relaxed. So you just can walk around and taste the nice wines that you like to taste. The winemakers itself that are pouring, there is the winemakers that are pouring the wine themselves, not anyone else.
Right.
So that's one of the things.
So when you go to character and yes. You're going to wine tables, you're meeting the guys, not the distributor.
You meet the producers.
Right.
Not the representatives, no?
When you say it's, you know, sort of low-key, the vibe, I'm guessing that's just the whole mindset of the collective winemakers and sort of the vibe of the fair, right? It's not like this...
More or less, yeah. It's less formal. I've never seen a person with a black tie there, so
okay.
That's why I like it.
I don't think you're going to either. How important is it to have a character? Is it important for exposure? Is it important for sales? All of the above? Connecting?
That's a very good question. How important is it for sale? I cannot tell you. But I can tell you it's important for me to go there because I want to see and meet the people that are drinking my wine. So I want to understand who I'm doing all this stuff in the vineyards for.
Right. So in a sense, you could be living in a bubble, just making wines the way you make it,
exactly.
Getting all this critical acclaim. But if you don't get feedback, you know, from people.
So the feedback that we get here is the applause for the artists.
after this show. No, that's
right.
The point.
Right.
So, yeah. I'm curious, who are the people? No, I mean, I have a lot of friends here and also fans, I think, in New York in the meantime, but I'm still curious about the people that are showing up there. No?
Let me be fair. For people who are not that familiar with you or your wines, and we're going to talk about it, so by the end of the interview, they'll have a sense. You know, your stature and your place in wine, in Central European wine and Austrian wine, is very high on the list and impeccable. You know, so for you to be here and for people of all walks, you know, to see that is as much a treat for them as for you to connect with them. Is it? It's attended by trade and by consumer, right?
I hope, yes.
You know, you'll see somms in retailers and you'll see, you know, collectors or drinkers, right? It's not just an industry thing and it's not just for the public tasting thing. I think there's still maybe...
No, I think character is also nice because it's for every different kind of people, no?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Is it an important... I asked you how important a fair like that is. Is this one of the more important ones just because of their whole philosophy and...
I just can tell you, I think if I look back, it has been the only fair I've been for... long time.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
Yes, it is important.
Yeah, so that it is important to you.
Yeah.
I'm curious, because this has been going on for years now, and why is Austria and Central Europe, for that matter, not just Austria, receiving so much critical acclaim and recognition for their wines? You've been making wines for years. You've been getting, but it just, I don't think I'm wrong when I think it's really, you know, blown up in a good way. Is that accurate, what I'm saying? I mean, it's, why now? I mean, you haven't changed the way you've made wines in the last 5-7 years.
That's a very good question.
What do you think?
I don't have an answer for this in particular. I just can tell you that I have the feeling that especially... Austrian wine. Wherever you open a bottle, the Austrian wine will always be one that has a certain kind of freshness that people make smile.
So, the reality is the kinds of wines that have been made are, like I said, getting the recognition. People open it up and it's like love at first sip type thing. Just because of the energy and how well made they're... You know, and all of that. I mean, I don't want to get into a whole dissertation about natural wines, but the acceptance of natural wines, organic, biodynamic, in the last few years, you know, has gotten better and better. I'm sure that's why people pay attention to Austrian wines.
Of course. I mean, if you see the whole movement of the world, everyone wants to know where his food comes from, how it was sourced. If you eat meat, you want to know if the animal has been treated nice. And so, of course, the same with wine.
Right.
No.
It's funny how wine, to some people, is the last thing they think about that way.
But,
you know, is your chicken organic?
Of course.
But it doesn't matter about the wine.
Yeah.
No, you know, it's crazy.
Same with coffee or bread, no?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Those are all things where, you know...
I always, when I talk to chefs... or coffee roasters, or the tea people, we always say we are colleagues. We are in the same boat, more or less. No.
Yeah.
Beside the fact that a winemaker like me, we are farmers too.
I think what's happening is you're primarily farmers.
Yes.
You know, I think the land is the thing that's. Would you agree the most important, and you have to protect it? I mean, the type of farming, and I want to talk to you about that. But here's something I'm curious about. Because like I said earlier, if people don't know you, they'll realize after the interview what you're doing, and they'll certainly admire you, and you know, they'll be curious to try the wines. I think one of the issues with a winemaker like you and a lot of other winemakers is, you know, you put your nose to the grindstone, you work very hard, fastidious, meticulously to do things the way you know is best, and you make these wonderful wines. But the thing that drives me crazy is there's not enough wine for everyone. That's sort of, does that frustrate you? I mean, I don't want to, it becomes culty or not everybody can get what they want and you want anyone who wants it. But how do you live through that? How do you react to that?
No, to me, that's, I always say fair enough. Things are, I'm happy that the quantities and this limited quantities that we produce, they are easily distributed in the world. I mean, we have fans around the globe, and so we try to make as many people as happy as possible. But
you don't think beyond what you make. You don't have to.
No, I don't.
What you make it the way you want. It goes to where it should.
Exactly.
And who, right.
We have the quantities we have, and that's how it is. I mean, it's like in a, if you have a 45-seat restaurant, you can't put in 90
right.
people. It's 45 seats.
Right. It'll be uncomfortable and the quality of the food will go.
And for us, we have 15 hectares, and that's the result. The outcome is 40,000 bottles, and that's it.
So because land is attainable, maybe it's too expensive, maybe it's not contiguously available, do you think down the road about, you know, adding property to make more wine?
Not really. What we've done is to move up the hills into the in higher altitudes, and so we just switched. So the quantities stay the same, and but the vineyards are a bit different. We changed.
Are you moving up the hills for a reason? Are you addressing particular issues, which are what?
We've done this the last 10 years, and if you think about the temperatures that are coming, the drought, things like that.
So you're trying to adapt to what everyone calls climate change.
I can tell you, the last 2 weeks, we have been spreading 800 tons of compost. I mean, that's a huge amount.
Why? Just for coverage, or
yes, kind of, because we were mixing it with straw and reed, but also to keep the soil healthy and keep it fit for the dry season next
right.
year.
You have to be more attentive with the way things are changing.
We are very attentive since very long time.
Right, you always have been, but you adapt to the changes by
yes.
yeah. I mean, that's
yeah.
crazy. Has that affected production?
Not really.
So you've been able to stay ahead.
But that's the signal that we seem to be on the right track.
Right.
If there is drought and very dry years and we have normal quantities, so everything is fine. No?
Right.
It says that the vineyards are in balance.
Right.
And that's what we want.
Right.
No?
Right. And you're very astute to that. We're talking to Christian Schieda. As you can hear, we are sitting outside downtown in New York City on a very active and busy night. But I think like Christian's wines, I think both of us like the energy yeah. of what's going on around us. All right. I don't want you to spend a lot of time on this, but I want you to kind of give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that basically got you to your own, you know, winery. You have a family history. Just fill in some of the pieces for that. You know, mm-hmm. your dad, you know, was a organic practicing viticulturist. But, you know, so tell me, give me a timeline on that.
Yes, you have to understand. The wines that were made during the Second World War from my family, for instance, they just were to feed the family and to exchange in Vienna with clothes or with other stuff. So it was not that kind of thing.
It wasn't a business, really.
It wasn't a business.
It was like a home wine.
Yeah,
making.
It was a home. Yeah. And then my father started in a certain way. And he was kind of part of the first. They had a group that was called Naturweingärtner. I mean,
These were guys in the region?
These were guys in the region.
Where they looked from the outside it as was, like crazy?
Yes, it was not that crazy, I would say. I mean, they did not use fertilizers, herbicides, things like that. So this was, if you think about in the 70s, this was a big effort, no?
Right.
Yeah, and this is where maybe I saw the first green things in my life, no? And then everything continues slowly. And I had my first contact with wine in the age of two. So there was
a
dripping bottling line, and I was tasting the ice wine that was bottled.
It's sweet, right?
It was very sweet. Yes.
So you were around it very young. And did you kind of stay around? I mean, I should know this, but I don't. Did you leave, the family and the winery to go to school or do other business things? Or?
I can tell you, if you grow up in a wine region and in a wine family, of course.
Go ahead. So if you grow up in a wine family.
Yes, if you grow up in a wine family, of course, wine is not a special topic anymore, no?
No.
It's a standard thing
right.
that you live with. And I have three brothers. And
are they actively interested, your brothers?
I started to take over with my younger brother.
Of your dad's winery, not dad's. Anything. Yep. Right.
But the winery was not in the condition like it was now. No? And
say not in the condition?
No, size-wise and... Also,
what about practices?
The practicing was not the point. It was also
that was okay.
The how should I say? It was a different time, also, no?
Right.
They were producing a lot of sweet wine. I think the portfolio they had, it was 30 different wines. No, every grape variety in different kind of style.
Were you planting those? I mean, was your dad just planting varietals?
Yes, yes.
Or just for the sake of not what was best for the climate and the soil, but just to make...
This was a different time and a different concept of wine, no?
Right.
And as I said before, it was the time when ice wine was a big shot. No?
What? That's so funny.
Yeah, maybe that's why I can't make this kind of wine, no?
No, you probably have no desire to do it.
It says... You see, everything starts in the childhood, no?
Right. Yeah. 2 years old.
Yeah.
So about how old were you with your brothers when you really dug in and started moving the winery?
I was 23, 25. But it didn't take too long because we found out that only one can be the person who says what is done. And so he left and became a teacher. And... now I'm the guy since...
When was that?
Since more than 15 years, no?
Okay.
Yeah.
So now you're the guy, like you said, one person has to make, the final calls. But you have your own ideas and you want to take it in a direction that is important to you. Tell me like some of the evolutions.
I want to tell you that I started to make these wines out of an inner need. I had to do it. I had to create my own way of wine and develop my own style. In these days, you have to understand, when we started almost 20 years ago with kind of natural wine, I could not call someone and ask how does this work. There was nobody.
It was all trial by error? You had to figure it out on your own?
I just knew that I didn't want to do it like the others did it. I wanted to find my own way, and I wanted to have it based on low alcohol and high energy.
So when you say you didn't want to do it the way others did it, they were practicing good practices, but you toned down the alcohol a little? You wanted a little more lower alcohol? That was one of the obvious things?
Yes, this was the first thing that I was searching for. I was searching for methods in the vineyards to bring down the alcohol.
Had you tasted any wines that were lower alcohol that you said, this is the kind of wine, or it was more of a vision?
I had a vision. I had a very clear and at the same time very abstract vision. Yes,
you were ahead of your time.
Yeah,
there.
I wanted to reinvent the red wine of Austria somehow. No,
were there? So you said there was really no one, you know, to go to or talk. Were there any influences? I mean, were there guys either in Spain or Europe, you know, that were...
No, if there was influence, then very indirect from France. France has France, always been...
Right. In the Loire,
very nice
the
for
Jura,
me.
Right.
Very nice for me to travel.
Right.
I mean, Loire was my destination in these days. Yeah.
So when you really took control of everything, you started making changes quickly. I guess at some point you figure out what you want to make. I mean, are the wines you're making today similar to... Boy, we got a lot of ambulances today.
They are similar, but quite evolved in style. And very, I would say, the wines now are... more grown up. And I can tell you, I mean, I made the first wines with 24, 25. Sometimes I think I had this vision, but in fact, I didn't know what I did.
Right.
I just did it.
Right. You know? That's how trial and error.
To be honest.
And then what did I do? And you do it again,
yes,
and it works,
yeah,
and all
you
of that.
You just do it, no? Because it feels right. No?
It's pretty amazing that...
To be, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, you're being brutally honest about it, and, you know, fortunately for you, you got to the right place. So, tell me a little about the land... Your hectares. I mean, tell me a little about the vineyard. You know, just tell people the location. You know, you're in Ilmitz in Burgenland, not an hour outside of Vienna. Climate, which we addressed a little because you're moving north. Mm-hmm. Type of soils you're dealing with, you know, and varietals. Just, you know, you get up every day and you walk out there and just tell me what we're seeing.
This is a very interesting thing. There is the family vineyards that are around Ilmitz that belong to the family. And then there is my own, that are in the hills of Burgenland. So quite steep and quite high in altitude. And this is where I do my stuff.
Now, do you farm both the family and yours?
Yes. Yes.
So
yes.
They're distinctly different and varietals and wines and all that.
Yeah.
So climate varies in those properties? I guess as you go further north, or up in the hills.
For me, the real things are there.
Yeah,
up in the hills. It's
that's you. You get the most.
Yeah, there's the most excitement. You have a view over the whole Burgenland. You see the lake. We are making wine.
What's the name of the
of
lake?
A beautiful
again?
Lake called Neusiedlersee.
Right, I can't pronounce it. That's why I'm making you do it.
Fantastic.
So there's a lake influence.
Yes, of course.
Which is positive.
And everyone who knows a bit about wine, that there is always great wine where there's a river or a lake. So,
right.
Yeah.
Really? I mean, from the Rhone to Bordeaux, you know, wherever.
Moselle, whatever.
Yeah, Moselle, I mean, is maybe one of the best examples.
Yeah.
So the varietals that you farm, you know, on your property, you know, that are in the hill, are they... Does it call for different varietals? I mean, on the family vineyards... Are you growing the same on both with different results, or you're taking advantage?
No. There's two things that we see. If there is old wines that are very
existing
nice,
old vines.
Existing, we take how they are. Come as you are. If you are nice,
it's a pleasure to
it's
have.
It's a pleasure.
Them. Yeah.
But if we make new plantings, we also try to use special varieties that are not so common. No. We've also test planted some Chenin Blanc.
Oh, really?
Yes. Or
so you're
some
willing
Chardonnay as well.
Right, you're willing to try anything.
Yeah, I'm open for anything. I mean,
that's great.
And I just want to say something else. We found very special methods to force the roots go deeper. We do double plant system.
D-O-P-P-E-L.
So that means...
Doppel planting is a way of planting.
Two wines side by side.
Two plants?
Two plants side by side.
So normally when people look at a vineyard, you know,
there is one.
You see a row of one. Yes,
there's one plant.
It's double.
Yes, it's double. So it's there's
creates competition.
This creates a lot of competition and forces the roots go deep and is leading to higher acid, to thicker skins, to less sugar production, which is leading to alcohol, no?
Those are all things that are important to the type of wines you like to make, right?
Yes, and so all these small details that I discovered and developed is leading to wine that is not driven by alcohol, but it's driven by its own inner strength and power and freshness. No?
So, silly question, on a go-forward basis, whenever you find the need to plant, would you always do doppel, or it only... It sounds like it's the right thing to do always, but...
No, you need to be very careful if it's a bit more drier.
Oh, okay. So you have to survey
you have to see these things as
well. Right, right, right.
So what else we do is then high-density planting, which means we have different distances. So we plant up to 9,500 wines per hectare. And then the next step is work with horse because they are too tight for a tractor, things like that. So
what does... When you plant high density, mm-hmm. what kind of, you know, grapes, what kind of wine are you getting out of that?
Pinot Noir, for instance.
But what's the characteristic of doing it that way?
Tricky to say it in a few words.
Really?
But the high density is according to the vineyard where it is and the variety. So in the end, I feel more energy and more uniqueness.
Right.
Because there's more roots, no? More roots, more pickup, nutrition, energy from the soil.
Right.
So, leading me to the next topic, soil, the most important.
And you don't treat it, you treat it naturally. Like you said, you compost if you have to, no fertilizer.
I mean,
do you till?
This is nothing. This is nothing we need to talk about. That's of course no, but
right.
We found our, I think, quite cool methods that are leading to very nice results in this kind of. Yeah.
That's great. Take me into the cellar. So, I mean, it's fair to say. You know, low intervention is a very important part of, you know, how you do everything out in the field. When you get to the cellar, everyone says this, and you'll say, the work's done out in the field. If you have vibrant, healthy grapes, now what's happening in the cellar?
Yes, that's kind of true.
But?
So, I think if you would see it in a whole year, I think 95% of the work we do is done outside.
Right.
And 5% is in the cellar. But these 5% can really, really infect the 95% you've done outside. So, for instance, we are using two different press systems. We have one vertical press, like a very, very special French.
Didn't you buy a real fancy, expensive one?
We have the same like these crazy Burgundy producers.
Right. Which is not... It's unusual for Austria to have those. Right.
But I was saving money for this for 5 years. So.
But was that to make you happy, or those presses do something that's important to the way you want to make the wine?
That's a very big part of how I want to make wine. So... I need to talk a bit wider. So, as we are not using a destemmer, for instance, because I think that a destemmer is doing 400-500 rounds per minute, and if you put a grape inside...
Just too much banging around too or much whatever. Banging, you don't want that.
Kinetic energy.
So, does that mean you destem another way, or you make wine with the stems?
We destem by hand,
okay.
Or we make wine with stems.
Right.
So, if you have the mesh with the stems, allows... To use lower pressure during the pressing. because the stems are leading the juice out of the mesh.
Right.
So we are pressing, all the wines are pressed with the power of a handshake. So, and I have a strong handshake, but
very
it's still
light.
A handshake.
Right. A little pressure.
You know?
Yeah.
And all these small details are leading then to one thing, you know, which is in your glass. So
right.
Yeah.
And you do spontaneous fermentation,
of
you know, indigenous and all that. You're using neutral barreling, Stockinger barrels? Or
we have fantastic Austrian partners that are making barrels in Austria.
With what kind of wood? Austrian wood?
Austrian wood. And
you found the characteristics of that wood works
They are
well
neutral because also the size. So if you have a 1,000 liter barrel, of course it is more neutral than a barrel with 200 liters because the surface is a different one.
Does that distinguish you from other winemakers, or are people in the region also using Austrian wood?
It's quite common.
It is.
But just today at the airport, I had a big discussion about barrels against amphoras and alternative vessels and these things. I said, guys, I'm honest. I don't think that I need an amphora in my cellar. We have these fantastic barrels.
It takes you to where you want to get to.
Yes.
I mean, there are some wineries with amphora, wood, concrete, eggs, new wood. I mean, you can go crazy, right? That's interesting. You know, that's pretty consistent.
I mean, I can go there to the copper and I select the wood for the barrels. I mean,
right.
That's fantastic.
That is
and
great.
The barrels we have are on a quality level like nothing else. No.
Right. So it's interesting. You are doing unique things in the cellar. You know, it sounds pretty simple, you know, using Austrian wood and basically using that one vessel, you know, for everything. It's simple, but...
We tried, really, to simplify things. So if you simplify things, other people, other staff will speak. So the vineyard will speak through. If I do high-end vinification methods, the wine will be driven by the method. If I take myself out of this game, the vineyard will speak. The big question is a different one. Is the vineyard beautiful enough to speak in a nice language?
Well, that comes back to you.
That's,
and how you do
and then
everything.
We talk about the farming again, which is leading that the farming topic is a never-ending topic because it starts and ends everything with the vineyard. So,
right.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, we talked about this before, but... Every year you learn a little more or you have to make a little tweak or things evolve, right? Whether you're forced by weather or, you know, yield or climate and all of that. All right. I got to let you go soon. So we got to wrap up. There's a couple things I want to do. I know you have a deep appreciation of art and your labels. If you look at them very closely, they're incredible. I mean, they're intense. You could look at them, you know, on a wall and go, oh, those are interesting. But when you get close to those, tell me about, obviously you wanted to take a vision you had of your appreciation of art. You have artist friends. How do you express that through the label?
I've always been searching for art that touches my soul. And the same with wine. And I think through the art on the label, I can express the soul of the wine also. For instance, there is this wine, Bird's Cape Pink Maceration. It's a mixed field with, I would say, 20, 30 different varieties in the vineyard.
So it's like a field blend?
It's a field blend, yes. And on the label, you have, I think, 50 different birds on it. And it should reflect the different varieties.
Right. Right.
But it's also fun because in Austria you say if you have a bird in your head, you're a bit cuckoo.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a bit...
Well, that's okay. People
yeah, that's
can think
okay.
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have friends. So you sit with friends and you take these ideas and say, listen, my Birdscape vineyard is all these varietals. Here's how I want to express. And they're able to, you know, put artwork together for you for the labels?
I mean, this label, the Birdscape label, is an art piece from 79.
Oh, really?
Yes. So we selected...
Right.
Sometimes it is like this, that we select an art from the past, But sometimes we talk to an artist and then he does a painting. So
that's great. It's always nice to, you know, drink a wine and ponder at an interesting label, too. You know, I was with Edward and Stephanie from Good Ogo, and they have a concept going there, too, with the family faces, you know, which is kind of a fun thing. All right. We do a thing on the show called The Wine List. I ask my guests five questions. Mm-hmm. I ask all my guests the same five questions because I think people are interested in your preferences. So this is spontaneous. You're not going to have a problem. So here's the first question. What are you drinking now? What are you tasting? What's in your fridge at home? What are you curious about, you know, experimenting with? Are there a few things that, you know, as the seasons change, you switch? What are a couple of things you're drinking now?
In my personal fridge, there's very little food and a lot of wine inside. It's mainly a wine fridge.
Is it your wines or your...
No. It's some, there's some bottles of mine.
So give me a couple of things that are in there that you've been tasting.
At the moment, there is... it's a bottle of Gabriobini inside.
Spell that for me.
Gabriobini. It's the label... it's an arrow. It's the bottle with an arrow from Italy.
Okay. Gabriobini?
Gabriobini, yes.
Bini.
Bini, yes.
Okay. Because I post this on our social media.
Oh, yeah, whatever, yeah.
Give me another one.
Then there is Strohmeier from Austria,
sure.
From Styria.
Sure.
Good friend of mine.
Styria is nice, making terrific
nice
wines,
guy.
Right?
Yes. There is a bottle of Muster.
Muster?
Also Styria, yes.
Okay. Yeah, Styria is a place to admire. Those are good ones.
Yes, and also there is two or three bottles of Bruyère Uyon from Jura.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I would think you'd be trying Jura and Loire wines.
And there's one more from Juan Ramon from Escoda.
What about any beer? Do you have any beer in there?
I don't drink beer.
No?
No beer.
I'm not a big beer drinker either. All right. Those are great answers. And like I said, I'm going to post. Second question, kind of the silliest. Your favorite wine and food pairing. Not what we think is a good one, but what do you like? It's obviously something you don't eat every night, week, month. But what's in your mind that you love? What's the right wine and the right food together?
For which white wine?
Any wine. What isn't there, like people say, champagne and oysters. Cabernet and steak. What do you have a... Maybe nothing stands out. White or red, it doesn't matter. You're stumped on this. I'm surprised.
I like rosé and hamburgers.
Okay. Yeah. People think rosé may be a little too light for hamburgers, but no, the no. Right rosé.
Choose a good rosé.
Yeah. I mean, that's a no-brainer. Yeah. I think that's a good one.
Yeah.
All right. Tell me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. I think a lot of people I talk to are in New York. What are great places by you in Austria, you know, by the winery? Are there a place you could walk in that has a great selection, they're knowledgeable, the vibe at the place is good? Are there places like that?
You mean in Austria?
Or anywhere else, both.
I mean, here in New York.
What do you like here?
I'm looking forward to go to Four Horsemen.
Okay. Instance. That's a show favorite. I was just with Justin. Can you think of anything else?
In New York, the Ten Bells. Looking forward.
You know what OG is. That's one of the original, yes. You know, natural guys. Oh. What about, are there any places like that within driving distance of your winery?
You mean in Austria?
Yeah.
Yes, there is a similar place like Four Horse. No, not really. These are originals here.
I know.
The Austrian... wine bars are less wine bars. They are more restaurants. They have more restaurant character.
So it's restaurants with some decent wine,
yes,
not
with
great wine.
Fantastic wine list, but more restaurant character.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what I like with these kind of bars here in New York.
Great food, great wine.
Great food,
both
but
beyond.
It's mainly bar.
Right.
And I understand that it's tricky to catch, no?
Right. Yeah? Well, I think... Four Horsemen caught magic in a bottle.
Oh, fantastic.
I mean, you know, I've been doing the show for years, and when I ask that question, it's probably, you know, and by no coincidence. All right, fourth question. Here's the question. I used to ask people, what's your favorite all-time wine? And what I was fishing for was, what was, Christian, what was like the rarest, most expensive wine you ever drank? I don't care about that anymore. In all your travels, back to that ice wine when you were two, the wines your dad were making, your early wines, what's the wine, one or two of them, that either influenced you, was a gateway to how you think about wine, that just changed? Is there a wine or two that, you know, you can't forget how important it is to you?
That's a very good question, and I'm not prepared for this.
Okay. Here's what I'm going to do. Is there an answer lurking somewhere?
There is an...
All right,
there,
so I'm going to get you offline and email you.
No. There is an answer. It is all time the same kind of wines. It's not one specific. If there is wine that comes from very, very special region where the weather is rough, where it's super hot, and they achieve to make low alcohol nice wine, I give full respect to these people.
So, like, I get exactly what you're saying.
Southern France.
In the toughest of Catalonia, circumstances, making exactly the best, you know, wines, the balance, yes, the finesse, you know, all of that balance stuff. That's an interesting answer, yeah, and that's a very cool answer.
I don't have a lot of respect for Disneyland wines, but I respect these
I totally get what you're saying. Yeah. All right, the last question... I think you should be able to do it. It's a tough question for some people. I ask people, I want you to recommend to me the best wine recommendations, a red and a white, for around $15, $20, $22 American retail. So I'll rephrase the question. What are the best values in wine if you had to drink a white or a red? You know, like Muscadet is great value. There are great Rieslings. Tell me a red or a white, a red and a white, that I should be drinking that is like the best bang for the buck.
For 15 bucks?
15, 20, 22 bucks American.
A bottle or a glass?
Bottle. Oh, you snob.
No.
You're not a snob.
I'm not familiar with the prices.
So then, to the best of your knowledge, answer that question. What is a great white wine? That's a good value. What's a great red wine? That's a good value.
In the whites, I love Riesling and Grüner.
So that's a real answer, because you can get like an Uli Stein, yes, for $22.
Yes.
You know, you can't beat that.
Yeah.
How about a red in the same vein?
Blaufränkisch and Gamay. So Blaufränkisch is Austrian.
Right. And it's not an expensive wine, and it's a terrific grape that you're
drinking. Blaufränkisch is in the full range, I think. You get nice stuff from 15 up to 100 bucks.
You do.
Depends on your budget.
I should know the answer to this. Do you make almost an all Blankenfrosch wine? Do you make, or mostly
we
blended?
We have, yeah, but not every year.
Right.
Because not every year is suitable to show full single variety performance.
So your lineup changes every year based on, but
we stay creative,
right?
Yeah,
but you're making literally dozens of different wines every year, right?
Between eight and ten.
Eight and ten is pretty, yes, much the solid
and
number.
And I always go with the flow. If the vintage is offering me this,
right,
I go in this direction.
Right.
If it's not offering, I go in another one.
I
take this very easy.
It's really the only way you're supposed to go. All right, Christian, we have to wrap up. Like I said, I got to let you go. You have a very, very busy week in New York. Christian Schieder's Wines will be at Caractere. That's Caractere. You can Google that and find out more about the fair. There are some events Christian will be at. They'll be posted on their website, actually. They put them there. So let me do a quick wrap up, and I want to get some information from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Leave a review if you like the podcast. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, on Twitter at BenRuby, but you could always reach us through the hashtag TheGrapeNation. At Facebook, we're at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, I will post Christian's wine list answers because he had some pretty cool recommendations there. Christian, if we want to find out more about you and the wines, I'm gathering you're not a big social media guy, are you?
No.
So I, you know, there's not. But if I want to, if I'm listening to this podcast and I'm like, I got to find out more about, you know, the wines and Christian, where do I go?
There is a very nice shop called Discovery Wines.
Okay, so basically go out to the wine shops, to your favorite restaurant sommelier, see if they have the wines, go to your favorite wine shop and talk to them. Okay. Yeah. All right, that's pretty simple, because you know there are some people in wine that are obsessed with social media. You're the opposite. It's all about the wines, and I love that about you.
To be honest, Sam, I don't understand the social media system, but
it's okay.
Yeah,
it's okay.
I'm happy with that.
It's okay. All right, so Christian, I want to thank you. I want to let you know that we did a little interview with Stephanie and Edward. We did a little interview with you. It's sort of a character Austrian show. We're going to release that. So thank you to Stephanie and Edward. Thank you to Christian, and I really have to thank Christian, because Christian literally got off a plane from Europe, headed to New York, and basically I let him go up and check in, basically met me right away to sit down and talk with me. And I thank Jenny Lefcourt for hopefully putting a little bug in your ear saying you should talk to this guy.
Yes.
So it was a pleasure to talk to you. Continued success. So thank you to Christian. Thank you to everyone at Heritage Radio. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.